Welcome to the Sunday night There is a Solution newcomer and returning member meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there'll be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So please help me welcome Nessa R., a compulsive overeater from Toronto, Canada. Welcome, Nessa.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity and the privilege to do service to this amazing meeting. So my name is Nessa and I am a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm supposed to talk about my story. I'm actually loath to talk about what qualifies me to be here, because we've all done the same things with food. And so my story is your story and your story is my story. Whatever you've done, I've done it too. You know, I'm just gonna say that I came into program in 2003 and I was almost 200 pounds. And I was very discouraged and demoralized because I had tried everything I could possibly think of. And I, you know, failed at everything. I mean, not that I never lost weight. Of course, I did lose weight in the various diets and things that I tried, but I was never able to keep it off. But what I really want to talk about is recovery. And specifically with a certain part of my story, I came in 2003, but I didn't recover. Came in January 3rd, 2003, and I recovered in December, or started my recovery journey in 2011. So I've been in a normal body weight and recovered for about 10 and a half years, maybe a little bit more. And I kind of want to talk about those first 9 years in OA when I didn't really recover and I didn't accomplish very much. And this was due to a whole bunch of misconceptions about program and about the steps that actually derailed my recovery. And these were ideas that I acquired, you know, as a result of attending certain meetings and hearing certain things and hanging out with certain people and, you know, whatever. And, you know, the problem with the misconceptions is not only that it blocked my recovery because I didn't do things the way they should be done, but I think that the most important thing for me is that they led to a huge discouragement when these misconceptions did not live up to reality. And, you know, when I first came into the rooms, I had such a great relief to know that there was nothing wrong with me per se, but that I had a disease. And all that despair that I felt kind of vanished at that first meeting. But after 9 years of struggling within the rooms, that despair and that demoralization came back. And I was starting to believe that I, you know, as the Big Book refers to in page 58, I thought that I was one of those who was constitutionally incapable. But then, I guess, I don't know, 2010 or something like that, I met my current sponsor, who was very steeped in the Big Book, had recovered according as a result of working the program exactly as laid out in the Big Book, who set me straight, really. So I want to talk about all these misconceptions, but by using the steps as a guide. So step one says, admitted we were powerless over food. And so originally I was told that I needed to put the food down. I need to identify what foods I couldn't eat. And I was told to make three lists, kind of like a green light food list, a red light food list, and a yellow light food list. And so the green ones are the green food, I guess, let's call it for brevity's sake, were the ones that I could possibly, that I could absolutely eat without possibility of trigger. The red foods were foods that absolutely triggered me. And the yellow foods were, I wasn't sure. And I have learned since then that there's no such thing as a yellow food. And I thought a yellow food is, you know, kind of made sense. You know, I'm not sure if it's a trigger for me or not a trigger for me. But yellow foods, I know now, are foods that I cannot eat, but I'm not ready to give them up. And so it kind of was, there was a tinge of dishonesty there. The meetings that I attended used phrases like sloppy abstinence, almost abstinent, 99% abstinent, and the misconceptions, I guess, kind of worked on me to lessen the discomfort of abstinence, because I didn't really need to like get truly, truly abstinence. And the big book says, in the doctor's opinion, it says, sorry, one second, I'm just gonna find it. It says, sorry, my big book is falling apart and now I cannot find the page. Okay, there it is. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And entire means that it has to be complete, 100% perfect, 100% of the time. And this to me sounded unrealistic, but now I know, having had none of my trigger foods for the past 10 and so years, that it is absolutely doable and within my ability. But all these misconceptions were designed to fool me into trying to avoid the discomfort of abstinence, because abstinence at the very beginning, before I'm recovered, it is uncomfortable. And the reason why is because I have a twofold malady. I have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And the allergy of the body happens when I consume my trigger foods. I have a biological mandate to keep eating them. When I put them down, then my mind gets to work to convince me that it's okay to go back to eat those foods. So when I'm not entirely abstinent, I never really get out of the allergy. And now I realize that all those years, even though there were times when I did get like a month of abstinence, you know, 6 months of abstinence, even a year of abstinence, I realize now that I was never really abstinent, because I never really gave up fully my trigger foods. So for example, sugar is one of my trigger foods. And I'm very, very careful. Now I consume zero sugar of any form or sugar alternatives. So most of the food that I eat right now is food that I prepare myself. And if I do buy prepackaged food, I read the labels very carefully to make sure that there's no sugar or sugar substitutes of any kind. But in those days, people would say, okay, if it's not in the sugar is not in the first two ingredients, I can eat it. And so me being a very competitive person, I said, okay, fine. You do two, I'm going to do five. You know, if it's not in the first five ingredients, I can eat it. But if I'm allergic to something, it doesn't matter if it's the 300th ingredient, I'm still eating it. And I have to drop it altogether. So that was a misconception. And there was a slogan in the rooms that said progress, not perfection. So when people talked about sloppy abstinent and almost abstinent, they would qualify by, well, listen, it's progress, not perfection. But that's not correct. The big book says we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. So this issue of progress, not perfection applies to steps 2 through 12, doesn't apply to step one, because step one is not a spiritual step. Step one is putting down the food. Then there was another misconception regarding the food, that once I put the food down, that would be smooth sailing for me. I would have no cravings. The chatter in my mind would disappear, and I would sail happily into the sunset. And that's not true. That's not the case. That chatter does not disappear just with putting down the food. If it did, any diet would have worked for me, but none of the diets did, because the chatter kept going. The only thing that quiets the chatter is working through the steps. The second part of step one says, admitted we were powerless over foods and our lives have become unmanageable. And the important thing here is, and I didn't understand this, I thought that my life was unmanageable, therefore I ate. But that was the wrong sequence. I ate, therefore my life was unmanageable. And I would make excuses like, well, I have so much going on and there's so many crises in my life. I'm like putting fires left, right, and center. I have no time. How can I put program ahead of my family? Blah, 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 right? And the thing is that if my life was manageable, I wouldn't need program. I need program specifically because my life is unmanageable. And my life is unmanageable specifically because I'm in the food. So that I also had to, corrected on. And it was a friend in program who taught me that, because people told me, well, you have to put program first, family second, and job third. And I was like, you're crazy. I'm never putting anything ahead of my kids. But the truth is that whenever I said this, it's not that I was putting my kids ahead of program. I was putting myself and my lust and desire for food ahead on everything else. Like that I was my number one priority. It wasn't my family. I had to accept that and really give focus to program. And this friend also said to me, when you put program first, everything else becomes first rate. That's indeed what happened to me. Like, I have a beautiful life now, excellent relationship with my family, more or less constant harmony. I mean, not that there's perfect and there's no fights and whatever there are, but nothing compared like to what it used to be like. So that's for step one. And then step two, it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That is just merely a conclusion that God is the solution to my problems. That's it. But I was under the impression that as soon as I took step two, that I would have an instant, amazing connection to God and all my problems would disappear. And of course, that didn't happen. And again, that led to more discouragement. It's like, oh, this program doesn't work. But at step two, I'm not supposed to have a connection with God because I am so blocked from God. There's two things that block me from God. One is the food, and the other one is myself. So my food, I put down in step one. So that's no longer an issue as long as it stays down. But the second one, me, is still an issue. And that's why I need the rest of the steps. So step two is just merely a conclusion that I need God to help me. I need God to do for me what I cannot do for myself. No connection with God there either. Step three, more of the same. Step three says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I thought like, how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? I don't feel God. And of course the answer is you don't turn your will and your life over to the care of God in step three. In step three, you merely make a decision. We always overlook that very important, crucial beginning of the step. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. So like things weren't working for me, because I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I don't know how to do it. And in the middle of the day, I'm still doing what I want. So of course it wasn't working. So it's kind of like if I say, okay, I make a decision to become a doctor. that decision doesn't poof turn me into a doctor, right? I just made a decision. And the decision is I'm going to do whatever necessary work I have to do to become a doctor, right? Like to go to medical school, to, you know, pass the exams, to do the internships, whatever it is that people do to become doctors. Just the mere decision doesn't turn me into a doctor. The same way that just making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God doesn't make me able to turn my life over to the care of God. So what I'm really doing in step three is deciding that I'm going to continue on with the steps and I'm going to work them to the best of my ability. So then I move on to the inventory process, which is steps 4 through 9. And in step 4, made a thorough and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And 5, we give it away to our sponsor. I admit it to God, to myself, and other human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. I thought that in step 4 and 5, what I wanted to do was convince my sponsor that I was right. So then my sponsor would say, yeah, you know, your life sucks. Everybody around you is wrong. You're 100% right. And you have every justification to be angry. But that's not what step 4 says. Step 4 says, stop looking at what other people do. Stop blaming others and look at yourself. How did you contribute to your situation? Even if it's only a minuscule part, even if the other people are 99% responsible for what's going on and you're only 1% responsible, you have to disregard that 99% and just focus on your 1%. Because otherwise I get stuck in my self-righteousness, in my justifiable anger, and I go nowhere except the food, which actually explains the many, people call them relapses, but you cannot really relapse if you're not recovered. Which of course I never recovered until this one time. So I kept going back into the food because my anger was so justified. I was stuck in it. I had nowhere to go. So the fridge was kind of like a good alternative. Step 6 became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And so step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. So people taught me, in the big book, there's only one paragraph for each of these 2 steps. And the reason is because God does all the work. And so, okay, fine, God does all the work, I have nothing to do. But that's not true. God does do all the work in step 7, but I have to do the work in step 6. It's kind of like if I put down the food entirely, God will remove the mental obsession. But if I'm still eating, you know, ice cream and cheesecake and potato chips, God's not going to remove the mental obsession. He can't, because I'm still in my allergy. You know, I'm not ready to give up, you know, my little G God. It's the same thing with my character defects. I have to put down my defects, which I do in step 6, and God removes them in step 7. So how do I put down my defects in step 6? You know, if my character defect is selfish, let's say I want my kids to do their chores first thing in the morning, you know, not to put them off, not to like talk to their friends and watch their YouTube and, you know, whatever it is that they do, you know, before they do their chores, right? So then, you know, and I nag them and nag them and nag them and I threaten them and I yell and, you know, that's selfish because it's what I want. So how do I give up my selfishness? They know they have to do their chores. I let them do their chores at their time. Whenever they have time, they have their own priorities. My kids are adults now. You know, they have their own priorities. Who's to say their priorities are wrong and mine are right? Of course, I think I'm right, but they also think they're right. So I need to act in an unselfish way to say, okay, you're not gonna nag, you're not gonna yell, you know, you're just gonna leave it in their hands, and that's that. You know, And, you know, God willing, one day, I can say that it's happened yet, God will remove my desire to control them and to yell and nag and all that. But I have to make an effort. Moving on to steps 8 and 9. And step 8, made a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I had been told, not by my current sponsor, obviously, but by sponsors before, to make a list of amends I needed to make in 3 categories: now, later, and never. That never is a problem, because the step says made amends to them all. And there was a person to whom I was never going to make amends. I was not willing. And that was my father. And the big book warns us that if we don't make amends to everybody, or are willing to make amends if we could, because some people we cannot, we're gonna eat again. We're not gonna recover. We're gonna eat again. You know, and so that didn't work very well for me. You know, I actually was never able to make amends to my father because he passed away prematurely and unexpectedly. But I eventually made amends to his second wife and their son, which was a lot more difficult amends than it would have been if I had made them to him directly. But that never had to go. You know, I can divide my amends into now or later, but that never had to be completely banished from the picture. And then in making amends, I had to make amends without any expectations. I have to remember there's only one reason why I make amends, and it's because if I don't make them, I won't recover. It's not that I'm going to help the people that I'm making amends to or whatever. I'm doing them for me. But by the same token, I have to make sure that I have no expectations. No expectations that my amends are going to be accepted, that I'm going to be forgiven or going to be admired. No expectations that the receiving person is going to make amends to them all, amends for their part in the whole situation. No expectations that the relationship will be restored. Nothing like that, because if I have expectations, I'm actually regressing. I'm going back to the selfishness. Then the expectation that relationship will be immediately healed, even when the relationship is healed, is not going to happen overnight. You know, like for example, healing the relationship with my husband and my children, right? Like I had no credibility. How many times did I say, yeah, I'm going to diet. Yes, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to change. Today is the first day of the rest of my life. You're going to see. And how many times did I break that promise? Like I had zero credibility. You know, I had apologized to them so many times, and I had done the same thing again and again and again. And it was like, I apologized and I do it again, and I apologized and I do it again, and so on. And I, you know, like I had no credibility. You know, like, you know, the big book says that there's a long period of reconstruction ahead, because I have to rebuild that credibility. You know, I couldn't even believe myself. Why would they believe me? Finishing the steps. You know, thank God I didn't do this time around, but there's, you know, like I've had sponsees who finish their amends in step 9, put the book away, and they're done. They finish the steps and they go back to doing things the way they normally done them, and then wondering why they found themselves back into the food. So there's no such thing as finishing the steps, because, you know, there's steps 10, 11, and 12. And those are steps that I have to live in for the rest of my life if I want to keep what I have, which, believe you me, I do. Because what I had before was so awful. You know, my marriage always almost broke up, my relationship with my children. I was fired from 2 jobs. you know, I couldn't make friends or keep friends. It was just such a, I don't know, like substandard life. And I mean, I think all of you can relate because we're all the same. So step 10 is kind of like a mini, I don't even know, I'm losing the word, I'm getting old, but it's kind of like all the steps condensed into one step. But the thing with step 10 is that it's very easy to just rattle it off, you know, call somebody, hey, I have a step 10 and, you know, this and that, and then change nothing, you know, and then I continue doing what I've been doing all along, expecting everything to change. And, you know, unless things change, things don't change. You know, it seems like a very obvious statement, but it's true. You know, if I keep doing what I'm doing, I keep getting what I'm getting. It doesn't matter how many step tens I do. But if I don't change the way I think and therefore the way I act, nothing's going to change. And that's the purpose of step 10. Step 10 is, you know, in steps 1 through 9, like I learned a way of thinking. And in step 10, I internalize it. It comes instinctive, a working part of my mind, so that instead of defaulting to the stinking thinking that I used to have, you know, the selfish and the rage and the nagging and the screaming and the threatening, I think differently now. And I can pause and back off and say, you know, like Nesse, how are you being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and fearful, so that I can get out of, you know, the unproductive feelings that always, and actions that always got me into trouble. But I have to be aware. I have to exert myself. I never wanted to exert myself mentally. Like I would rather run like a 75 mile marathon. And I tell you, I'm a compulsive non-exerciser. I would rather run 75 miles and exert myself mentally than stop and say, you know, just stop, think what your part in it is, and don't do things the way you've normally done them. Do things differently until they become second nature. If I don't do anything to change, I cannot expect things to change. And then step 11, I never got to step 11 before I met my sponsor ever. I did pray and I meditated a lot. I mean, like, you know, like from the moment I came into program in 2003, people would say, oh, pray about it. I have this problem, pray about it. But, you know, like prayer and meditation are just a minimal part of step 11. You know, step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. You know, that instant connection that I wanted in step 2, that's what step 11 is. That's that connection with God. Step 11, I'm able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's the solution. Step 11, I have arrived at that solution that I've thought I should have had in steps 2 and 3. And prayer and meditation are a small part of it. And why till step 11? Like, why couldn't I have it in step 2 and 3? You know, after step 11, I have already removed what blocked me from God in steps 4 through 9. And I continue to clear the line with step 10. You know, so prayer and meditation is not the most important part of step 11. It is just a means to a goal. Thank you. You know, like when I was praying in 2003, 2004, you know, 2010, you know, it was kind of like I was talking to a line that had a lot of static where I could not be heard nor could I hear. But in step 11, I can be heard and I can hear. That is the relationship with God. And of course I do have to pray and meditate, you know, but now it serves a purpose. Step 12, I always was told step 12 is doing service. So arrive early at your meetings, help set up the chairs, stay late, help clean up, help put away the chairs, blah, blah, blah. You know, call people during the day, you know, like take the week care list. And all that stuff is important. I'm not knocking it at all. But that's not what step 12 says. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, meaning I have worked the steps according to the big book and I have recovered. We try to carry this message. What is this message? The message of recovery in the big book, you know, to other compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles, again, steps 1 through 12, in all our affairs, not just with fellows in program, but in my family, in my work, in my community, in my place of worship, wherever I go, I have to keep this. I have to keep this in practice. I still have to help. I help to set up, help clean up, help make coffee, or you know, like whatever it is. But that's not step 12. Step 12 is passing on what I have. And step 12 is something that I can do only when I'm recovered. The big book says in page 164, you can't transmit something you haven't got. When I came here, I wanted a thin body. I didn't even want recovery. Wasn't on my radar screen. I had no idea what it was. But now that I know, that's what I need to pass on in step 12. I guess with that, I am going to pass. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Nessa. I've never heard anyone share as you did on the misconceptions on the steps, the misunderstanding. And I especially like to share on step 10, the caution of not doing it routinely, that it's a new way of thinking. Thank you so very much.